Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Disagreements over immigration reform often center around policy and ideology. How can we best regulate the flow of foreign-born residents into this country? And what should permanently disqualify somebody from resident legal status? But on the ground, in the chaotic and understaffed immigration court system, caseloads have more than tripled in the course of a decade, pushing waits for adjudication to an average of 2 years. In that environment, policy discussions sound like a luxury. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Diane Solis has been reporting on the immigration court system for the Dallas Morning News and joins us to talk about why the backlog has grown so large and why it is likely to get worse before it gets better. You can read her reporting online at dallasnews.com. Diane, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Nationwide, the backlog of cases on immigration court dockets is approaching 475,000. It's hard to get one's head around a number that large. How many courts and judges are there to process those cases?
There's about 250 judges around the nation. We have 6 courtrooms in Dallas and 6 judges here. And Dallas, it takes about 2 years for a case to go through the process, but it's worse in places like Colorado, where it takes 3 years. And some individual cases can even take 5 years to make their way through.
Who has to go before an immigration judge? Is it only people accused of violations?
That's the large bulk of them, mm-hmm. And it's been very startling in the last 2 years to sit there and bear witness and see little kids who have to go before the judge. And these are the kids who came from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras in 2014 as violence in those countries started surging and as rumors started growing that if you came to the United States, you might be given refuge.
The article that you published last month opens with the story of a South Korean man who's been living in Dallas, had been living in Dallas on an expired visa. How was he caught?
He was traveling to Los Angeles and was passing through El Paso, your hometown, and there are more Border Patrol folks running around that area. And so he was stopped and he was asked for his documents and he disclosed that he had an expired visa, and that spun him into the court system.
But he'd been living in the U.S. He'd been working. What was his life like before he was caught?
I think it was quite good. He has a family business, a donut shop in Irving, and he has 2 wonderful sons who are doing well, I'm told. And he has a wife, and she recently got the green card of legal permanent residency. So with that, he is arguing, or his attorneys are arguing, that he should be given derivative status. But unfortunately, he won't get to argue that at the crucial merit hearing for almost 2 years. That's because of the backlog.
So it's December 2017. What is his status in the meantime while he waits to have his day in court? Is he living at home? Is he living in a detention center?
Oh, he's living at home. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not in a detention center. That's a great question. Thousands of the Central Americans who have come through the U.S. Aren't so lucky. The mothers who come with children, for example, have been put into very controversial detention centers in 3 locations around the U.S.
Tell us a little bit about the steps in settling a case in immigration court. Aside from the staffing and resource shortages, what has to happen before a judge can rule on any particular case? What kind of information do people have to bring with them?
You get charged first, mm-hmm. and something called an NTA is issued, and that's a notice to appear. And you're told that you need to appear on such and such date in such and such court before an immigration judge and hear the charges and then plead and try and make a case, if you think there is one, that you have a right or a need to stay in the U.S. Need could be that you want to seek asylum. And that's been the case with many of the Central Americans.
But they have to prove or demonstrate that the threat to their existence is personal rather than general. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. You have to prove that you're being persecuted based on five different grounds. And it's race, religion, ethnicity, and social group. The latter is where a lot of folks try to make their case, and it's quite difficult.
Mm-hmm. Because you can't simply say, for example, I come from a failed state, and it's sort of dangerous for everyone in general.
That is not going to win you a right to stay in the U.S. No, it's really hard. And, you know, often you see people in tears because they know they can't articulate the level of violence that they face. And so the issue becomes not one of the truth of the violence, but one's ability to articulate that truth well.
So, Diane, you said that people accused of immigration violations are charged, but am I correct that they don't have a Sixth Amendment right to counsel if they can't afford somebody? You write about a lot of people who come into these proceedings and they don't have attorney representation.
You know, the vast bulk of immigration law is a civil procedure, mm-hmm. and it's not a criminal procedure. So if you're indigent and charged criminally, you can get a government attorney, but that's not what these cases are. It's a very, very much debated point right now because these children have such a hard time finding attorneys if they're unaccompanied, and they don't have the right to have a government-paid lawyer at their side. There's even a case in Seattle brought by the ACLU to try and get the government to supply attorneys for unaccompanied minors.
It's hard to imagine a child, particularly one without English skills, trying to navigate this process alone.
Well, there's interpreters in the court,
mm-hmm.
Lots of Spanish language interpreters, and they're quite good.
So if you speak Spanish and you don't speak a lot of English, you're in good shape. But if you speak a language that is less common, it may be harder to find someone.
That's right. That's right. For example, if you speak Albanian, they often have to schedule somebody to hear your case. So there's another delay. If you're Guatemalan and you're indigenous and you speak MAM, there are only five interpreters certified in all of the United States for that language for the courts. So there's another delay.
I'm glad you brought this up because people may not be aware that people from, you know, majority Spanish-speaking countries may not be fluent in Spanish.
That's right. And, you know, I've been in court enough that I've seen it sometimes with folks from Guatemala who speak Quiche or speak MAM.
So you have sat in on a number of these proceedings, and the word that you use more than once is chaotic. What makes it chaotic in these courtrooms?
It can range from the fact that people don't have an attorney and try and make their case and stumble through and don't understand certain concepts, to the fact that attorneys that they thought they hired don't show up, to the fact that little toddlers can get away from their moms and run up to the judge or start yakking.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in 2014, when the surge came, there was one judge who really looked quite fatigued.
So there are, did you say 200 and something judges across the country?
250 or so around the nation, and now there's six in Dallas.
So last year, the Obama administration hired an additional 23 judges, but 22 left or retired.
That's right. Yeah. So they just can't, they're just treading water. Moreover, and most importantly, there are more than 100 judges who are eligible to retire right now. So the head of the immigration courts is quite worried and as wants to hire and talks about hiring more, maybe up to 100. But you know, we have to remember that that's about the number of judges who are eligible to retire.
What are the impediments to just upsizing the court system that deals with immigration?
Well, the judges have a union, and they've argued that they need more resources. I just looked at the proposed 2017 budget, and they're asking for $428 million. The current budget is about $421 million, so it's not much more in funding, considering the scope of the backlog and the need. A lot of that money is going to go toward establishing an electronic filing system. It often surprises people that there isn't an electronic filing system like we know in our federal court system.
This surprised me. Will you describe how files are moved around in federal immigration courts just in Dallas County?
Yeah, the government attorneys from ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Unit, have these huge carts, kind of like shopping carts, and they pile their cases into that to the carts, and some law books and hand sanitizer and Kleenex, and they set up shop at these desks in front of the judge. Recently, I was in court, and they called for a man whose name, I believe it was Alfredo, and sitting across was an Annabelle, and they had pulled the wrong file.
So good luck to Alfredo. He has to wait until they found his file, which could be anywhere.
Hopefully it wasn't just anywhere.
Right,
hopefully
right.
They found it, and it was just a question of pulling the wrong digit.
Mm-hmm. I mean, surely this is frustrating to the people doing this work every day.
Yes, I think it is frustrating. I think the judges take a lot of it in stride. Where I see annoyance is when an attorney doesn't show up and the immigrant says that they hired one. And I have seen what to me looks like a shaming process. They will call the attorney in open court and have the speakerphone on and ask why the attorney didn't show up.
Is there no criminal or professional penalty for an attorney not showing up to represent a client who has hired them?
I believe that there is. Mm-hmm. I believe that there is. And I'm not sure how stiff the sanctions are.
But again, if you, the immigrant, have shown up in court and your attorney's not there, there's going to be another delay.
That's right.
And you have to just put it off.
That's right.
What do people do in this time that they're kind of in legal limbo? Are they able to work? Do they go back to the jobs that they had before, which are sort of under the table?
You know, I think in each case it can be different. Some people might have permission to work in certain asylum proceedings. And for the other people, I'm not quite sure how they work around that.
We're speaking this hour with Diane Solis. She's a reporter for the Dallas Morning News who's been covering lately the backlog in immigration courts. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes, and if you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Diane Solis, who's been reporting for the Dallas Morning News on the backlog in immigration courts. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Diane, the backlog of cases has almost tripled since 2006. Why are there more cases for the courts to decide now? Is it a matter of more immigrants or more enforcement or something else?
You know, illegal immigration from Mexico has actually gone down. And what happened is that under-resourced courts in 2014 saw an increase of migrants from Central America. It was called the surge. It was unprecedented. All these unaccompanied minors traveling without a parent or mothers traveling with little kids. And in order to try and deter that, the government said, let's make these cases a priority. So that caused a backup. And that migration ebbed some, but recently in the last 4 months, it's increased again. That's got some people worried.
And is that, you know, that new surge in immigrations, is that because conditions in their home countries are bad again?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Particularly in El Salvador, there's been a huge increase in violence. It's now believed to be the most murderous country in the world that is not at war. And Salvadorans will argue, we are at war. You really don't understand how bad it is.
And when those Central American cases are fast-tracked, how fast is fast-tracked?
Initially, they had something called rocket dockets. That's what the attorneys called it. And so a case was heard within 21 days from the issuance of the charging document. And you usually got that charging document within days or a week after passing across the border. And they've recently changed that, I believe, to up to, I think, 90 days.
Still much faster than anyone else, but hardly rocket speed.
Right, right. It's still a priority. And so if you're somebody who comes from South Korea, or you come from Albania, or you're Mexican, you aren't at first in line.
Let's go back to the phones now, or let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Sonia on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Sonia.
How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm fascinated because I couldn't hear Diane as I was calling, and the question I had was that I understood only once during the news reporting, at least on telly, that when that surge happened, that prior to that, that it was George Bush who had actually said that due to, and then it's what, El Salvador has population relative is the most dangerous country in the world. I thought that this government under George Bush said that we would give legal asylum to some of those minors. And I want to know if that's so, because I heard it spoken of so little, but it might certainly contribute to understanding why some people thought they could come or send the children. Is it so that Bush said this?
Thanks for your call. What do you know about that, Diane?
You know, it was Obama who said that recently, and people had argued for a while that the unaccompanied minors and some of these mothers coming with children were actually refugees. And if you're a refugee, you get to stay in the U.S. lawfully, and you get a work permit, and you get put on a pathway to citizenship, most importantly. And December 2014, we established a policy that started refugee proceedings for people under 21 who were still in country. And there were a few people who got in under that policy, including a young woman who has settled here in Dallas and arrived just weeks ago. And there were also criticism of that because they thought it wasn't generous enough, and that it was really hard to argue that people who were under threat of violence would want to stay in their country. So recently the government said that they would establish a refugee program for folks from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, and that they wouldn't have to apply in their countries.
You've written of late about some raids to round up undocumented immigrants, which I gather some people have cheered and encouraged and other people have been upset by. First of all, what do you mean by raid? Are immigration officers, you know, going to people's homes? Are they going to workplaces? What do these look like in practice?
When the numbers of Central Americans started climbing again, the government got concerned, of course, and the Washington Post broke a terrific story that said that the Homeland Security folks were thinking about starting what folks in common language call a raid, but it amounts to immigration agents coming to the door and knocking on it and asking for, you know, such and such person. And so January 1st and January 2nd, that did happen in three states, including Texas. And there were some folks that were picked up in North Texas as well. And we wrote about a family in Irving that was taken away. And the woman had hired an attorney, a local Dallas attorney, whom I know. And her asylum case was denied. She didn't realize that she had the right to appeal, and she was taken to Dilley, Texas, and put into detention with her two children, who were 6 and 9, two sons. And she now has pro bono attorneys who have started an appeal process for her for asylum. She was also taken from Dilley and moved to a family detention center in Pennsylvania. And that's where she is now, and we're hoping to write a follow-up to her story.
What is family detention like?
I've never been to a family detention center. To the latest ones that we have three in the United States. We have two in Texas and one in Pennsylvania. The last one I went to was just outside of Austin and was called Hutto. And I didn't go inside. I was outside, and it looked like sort of kind of like a lockup, not like a jail from the outside, but clearly people couldn't leave, and children were staying there. So there were real questions about how they were treated and how they were fed, and were they getting educational classes.
So we know, the best statistics are that there are 11 million foreign-born residents of the United States without legal documentation to be here. Why in these raids is one family targeted when there may be, 1,000 others that are left alone? Have you learned anything about that?
We thought that the government was going to target Central Americans who were recent arrivals, meaning that they came in 2014. And they did target they appeared to have targeted recent arrivals. We're not quite sure, but there were also Mexicans that were picked up. So they weren't all Central Americans. Ultimately, only 121 persons. And there are people who want a much harsher crackdown, and note, 121 persons isn't that many people. And there were others who said, this is really terrible because these people are fleeing violence in Central America. But again, some of the people that were taken were Mexicans.
It seems very expensive to keep people incarcerated or detained at government expense while awaiting adjudication of their cases. Do you know how decisions are made about who will be locked up and who will be allowed to sort of go about their business until their case comes on the court docket?
People who are considered flight risk are often placed in detention. Other people are allowed to go about their business and appear in court at the next scheduled hearing date. Some people are also given ankle monitors, which is much cheaper.
What happens in cases where, you know, adults have been here long enough to start families here, may have some U.S.-born children? If they're deported, what happens to their children who are U.S. citizens?
Attorneys will argue that immigrants in that kind of situation have equities, certain equities, and often will ask for something called prosecutorial discretion, basically a break. And sometimes they'll get it. It depends a lot on whether they have a criminal record. Mm-hmm. And under immigration law, misdemeanors are often considered significant. They use that phrasing, significant misdemeanor, and it's harder to get prosecutorial discretion under those circumstances. And what do I mean by significant misdemeanor? Or more importantly, what does the government mean by that? They mean DUI and DV, domestic violence convictions.
So is this, and forgive me, this is not my term, but when you talk about prosecutorial discretion, is this where the term anchor baby comes from? The idea that if you have a U.S.-born child, some people might be able to use the status of that family to try and stay longer. It sounds like it doesn't work very often.
I think someone could construct an argument based on that, that kind of thinking. Sure. I think anchor baby is a term that's used pretty broadly.
Yeah. I want to talk about immigration and customs enforcement attorneys and what their job is. Are they essentially the prosecutors in these cases where immigrants are asking for permission to remain in the United States after an immigration violation?
That's correct. That's how it works.
And are they charged with sort of sifting through who deserves to stay and who doesn't and presenting that to the judge, or is their goal to get people out of the country?
I think that they sift through the details of cases and they're fairly careful to try and find out if people might have derivative U.S. citizenship, for example.
What does that mean?
Derivative U.S. citizenship means that your parent is a U.S. citizen and that perhaps you were born outside of the U.S., but because your parent was a U.S. citizen, you derivatively get that citizenship, even though you think that you are, Panamanian or Mexican. You have a right to be in the U.S. if you have U.S. citizenship. You don't get deported, usually, if you have U.S. citizenship.
You write about the fact that there have been some cases where the attorney representing the immigrant and the ICE attorney with the Immigration and Customs Service agree on what should happen to an immigrant, but judges, it would seem that that would make things very easy to process and things could go forward, but that's not necessarily the case.
In Dallas, that's not necessarily the case. And there's one judge in particular who some people are upset with because he goes his own way.
You didn't name that judge in the piece, and you're not naming that judge now. Is there a reason why?
It's the subject for an upcoming article. And a lot of people know who he is.
And there are some attorneys who represent immigrants that charge extra.
That's right. I know somebody for that same judge who I may be writing about later. They charge $1,000 more.
What does it cost to hire an attorney to work with someone on an immigration case? Are these attorneys somehow more affordable than other attorneys? And we shouldn't assume, by the way, that all undocumented immigrants come to this country with no resources, but generally speaking, they're believed to be lower income maybe than the average resident.
Yes. Lately, I've been looking at fairly complicated cases involving asylum pleas or something called special immigrant juvenile status for unaccompanied minors. And those cases are expensive. You hire a veteran attorney, it could be $8,000.
So while everyone is waiting, you know, more cases continue to pile up on the dockets. Is anyone sort of in the legislature looking at ways that we could make this work more expeditiously?
There was a congressional hearing on this in D.C. in December, and I was surprised that it wasn't more financially focused. There was one representative from the Republican Party who said that the backlog was de facto amnesty. He was quickly followed by someone from the Democratic Party who said the under-resourcing, the underfunding of the courts undermines due process. And they didn't move beyond the sloganeering to get at the fact that the immigration courts only get about 2% of the entire immigration law enforcement spending. That's so little.
Is there a reason why people who commit these violations aren't just summarily deported?
Often they are, actually. If they're Mexican, they often can take something called voluntary departure.
Not so voluntary.
You know, there is a lot of terms that seem sort of illogical, but that's the term that's used. And it's very important because if you take voluntary departure, I'm not an attorney, but you have a chance to come back to the U.S. lawfully.
After you, it's like a 10-year, is it a 10-year waiting period?
You know, that's a question that's best asked for an attorney.
We'll save it. We're speaking this hour with journalist Diane Solis. She's been reporting for the Dallas Morning News about the backlog in the immigration courts in Dallas and around the country. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Diane Solis, a reporter for the Dallas Morning News. You can read her work about immigration and the backlog in immigration courts online at dallasnews.com. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Do you have the sense, Diane, that there is political will to make this work better?
I don't have a sense that there are a lot of eyeballs on the immigration courts. No, I think that folks focus a lot on the border and on securing the border, as they like to say. But the immigration courts are a linchpin of our entire system that looks at who gets to stay in America or who does not.
Are people who are waiting sort of grateful for the time, or can they not really move forward with their lives knowing that they may, whenever they get their day in court, be sent home again?
You know, the delays put a pause on a case. And I think if you have a weak case to begin with, the pause is probably a great thing. But if you have a strong case, the pause is not something you want. You want to get on with it. Say you have a strong asylum case. You need to call on witnesses. Well, the longer you delay, the harder it is for your witnesses to remember things, or they could die and your case falls apart. Or country conditions can change and your case falls apart.
So if things improve back home, regardless of why you came in the first place, then you may not have a case.
If you're arguing that you're fleeing violence back in your home country because such and such political party is persecuting you and a new party comes in, your case has fallen apart.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Brooke in Fort Worth. Hi, Brooke.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I am curious from your guest's opinion and from all the expertise that you've gathered through your reporting, if you believe that the current Republican frontrunner's solution to immigration being a massive deportation of 11 million people in one big swoop and the building of a giant wall between the United States and Mexico, is that a practical solution? And do you think that it would in any way be effective in managing the immigration problem?
You know, I try to avoid giving my opinions on issues like that, but many have noted that it would be extremely costly to try and deport that many persons. And moreover, so many of these families now have U.S. citizens, and they would be fracturing families. And I think it's a point that gives some pause. Of course, not all, but some people, that fact that you have mixed status families gives many, many pause.
It's interesting to think about, you know, if there's this backlog in just trying to get cases processed now, it seems that there would be a backlog in any effort to try to, you know, forcibly remove a very large number of people.
Yeah, I'm starting to listen to people talk about that, Chris, that the whole due process that one would go through would be just monumental.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Douglas in Dallas. Hey, Douglas.
Yeah, hi. Nice show. I always listen to you. I became a KRA member because of your show.
Thank you.
Boy, I came here when I was 17. I came illegal. Like I was telling to the other lady before, I came because I have to. I was raised in El Salvador on the Civil War. Me and my wife, we're both from over there. We've been here about 27 years. And, you know, I like your show and on all the comments that you guys doing, because sometimes some people that don't know our lives, they have a different point of view. And we came because we need to. We need to survive, you know, and that's why we came. And thank you for your show and all the comments that you guys doing. Maybe people can have a immigrant point of view. Now I'm a U.S. citizen. I got a kid on a university, another one that is going to graduate from high school. Thank you. Thank you for the show.
Thank you for your call, Douglas. I wonder about the perspective that you have, Diane, talking to people who are immigrants to this country, some of whom may have, you know, obtained all the necessary documents and some of whom may not have and be in the country without documentation. What have you learned about their lives that maybe the average person sort of looking at this from a distance doesn't understand?
One of the big issues that one hears a lot is that folks should just get in line. If you're Mexican, there isn't much of a line to get into. And immigration laws are quite complex, and I don't think people quite grasp that people would like to get in a line and do things lawfully, but if they're a low-skilled worker, it's quite hard. And many have pointed out that there's a bipolar immigration policy that goes on depending on what country you're from. If you're from Cuba, for example, there's a Cuban Adjustment Act that essentially makes it so easy for you to come here lawfully and be put on the pathway to citizenship. That's not true for Salvadorans. So you have a situation where you can go to the Rio Grande River and look at two immigrants on rafts, and one raft, if it contains a Cuban, well, it means that the Cuban gets to stay. And if the other raft contains a Salvadoran, it means that they have an arduous struggle ahead.
What's different about Cuba? And I completely take the point that things are very tough there and it is not a democracy. But why have we had a different policy?
It's a policy that was constructed during the Cold War, and because we had very strong anti-communist policies, and so Cubans have benefited from that.
We've talked mostly about immigrants in this conversation from Central America. We mentioned Albania a couple of times. Has the resettlement of refugees from places like Syria and the Middle East been part of any of this? I'm guessing that these are individuals who come over with documentation. So are they in the court system as far as you've observed, or are we still talking about mostly people from Latin America?
I haven't seen any Syrians in the immigration courts yet. And many or some of the Syrians who come over vetted by the United Nations and by the State Department, and they come over with what's official refugee status. So they are good to go, so to speak. They can live where they want, and they have work authorization, and they can move after about a year onto the pathway to citizenship. They get a green card, the green card of legal permanent residency, hold that for about 5 years, and then they can apply to be naturalized to become a U.S. citizen.
Can you talk about what it means to have an expired visa? Is this mostly people who have come here as students? Are expired visas, things that are granted to, pleasure travelers? Who are these people?
They can be work visas as well, and they can, and they could be business visas, and people let them expire and then just stay. One of the heads of the Department of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, some years back estimated that about 40% of the folks in the U.S. without proper authorization had come on visas and had overstayed them.
You mentioned earlier that undocumented immigration from Mexico has fallen off over the past few years. Is that a matter of economics, or is it a response to some kind of public policy to make it more difficult to stay illegally?
The Pew Research Center has done excellent analysis on that, and I think it's a combination of the fact that it's harder to come across now, and that Mexico's economy, relatively speaking, had gotten better, and there was a demographic change. There simply aren't the bumper crops of young men seeking work like there was.
It's interesting to think about U.S. immigration policy and our efforts to locate and deal with people who are here without legal permission. Because on the one hand, people who say, there's this sort of relentless pursuit of undocumented immigrants, you can understand their perspective. And you can also understand the perspective of people who say largely a blind eye is turned to the presence of undocumented immigrants. I wonder what your perspective is on this.
Employers who hire unauthorized workers aren't prosecuted very much in the U.S. They simply aren't. So I can see why that argument has muscle, clearly. And we haven't seen the raids on employers that we saw in the past. Oh, it's been maybe 10 years ago now that we had raids on meatpacking plants, and that was quite significant. And it's just been a while since we've seen that kind of enforcement. But on the other hand, we've seen a doubling of boots on the ground at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Is there any evidence that people from Central America are stopping when they get to Mexico and staying there because things are better than, say, El Salvador?
I think that they are. And I was in Mexico looking at that in 2014, looking at that precisely. There were a lot of Hondurans living in a place called Ecatepec outside of Mexico City, just north of it, and settling. And it's because every time they stopped on the train, there was somebody who shook them down for money. And many of them just simply had to get more cash so they could continue the journey on.
There is a certain irony to the fact that I know that Mexico is really concerned about illegal immigration across its own southern borders.
There is a lot of irony, and it's always been illuminating to go to the Guatemalan border and see how the Central Americans are treated by the Mexicans. And there's a river there, the Usumacinta River, and you see a lot of people coming across, or you used to see a lot of people coming across on the river in rafts.
Do I have this right from your piece in mid-February that 25% of people who go through the immigration courts who have attorneys are able to actually stay in the country, but just over 1% of those who try to process their own cases without attorneys are allowed to stay? Is that correct?
You know, I looked at that about 2 hours ago, and there's a nonprofit at Syracuse University that studies that kind of thing, and they found that women who came and didn't have an attorney had less than 2% chance of being able to stay. For unaccompanied minors, about 15% who didn't have an attorney were able to stay. So having an attorney makes an enormous difference. But looking at those two different groups, you can see that it seems that the children were treated a bit more generously than the mothers.
Are we set up in this part of Texas, in North Texas, to continue receiving unaccompanied minors as they're coming across the border? Have we reached the limits of our capacity to care for these children?
Well, I looked into that to see whether we still had people living in temporary shelters just south of Dallas, and we don't. What happened is that they opened up bigger places for people to go. Some military bases opened up, I think, in New Mexico, for example. So people could be sent there. Children could be sent there. Minors could be sent there, children and teenagers. And in January, we started to see the numbers come down some.
Diane Solis is a reporter for the Dallas Morning News. You can read her work about immigration and specifically the backlog in U.S. immigration courts online at dallasnews.com. Diane, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Tori Whitley. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.